I'm going to kick the recording off now.
Okay.
And this is episode two, Hard Salt Beef. I thought this was a massive step up from the first episode. I really, really, really enjoyed this one. It felt a lot less like the introductory episode and more like we're learning the characters that we've been introduced to. Also, we were introduced to some other sorts of hard salt beef at the beginning, weren't we? That was quite the
Maybe not
interesting.
so hard.
Yeah,
We have to talk about that because that was,
Well, not so
late for a
hard.
jump scare of a
flaccid beef.
episode. That had to be a prosthetic, right?
I assume so. In the same way, I think Hodor's was a prosthetic, wasn't
Well,
it, back in the
no, I
day?
don't think it wasn't a process. I think he's generally that blessed.
I can't speak to it.
That actor's in the wrong kind of acting job.
I see I think it's real. I think Hodor's is real because there was no need for that scene. I think that the actor who plays Hodor basically was like, "Come on, let me just do a nude scene. Just the one." I go, "Oh, go on then."
When you got it, flaunt it.
Yeah, sort of. I feel like I don't know. I can't help but think that for a scene that you could cut that scene out and nothing would change.
I mean, I mentioned last week that the like preamble, like warning at the beginning of the episode in the last episode was like strong language from the outset, and this one had strong language and scenes of nudity from the outset, and they weren't kidding.
Yeah, scenes of massive nudity.
So yes, speaking of that, I think in some of the behind the scenes stuff, they were saying that basically, Sir Arlen was so well blessed that it like had an effect on his like confidence, and that why it contributed to why he was such a respectable knight, and that he didn't feel the need to show off
He was
in
confident
any
in his
or
masculinity.
compensate to compensate in any other kind of way.
I mean, I wish that was true of just
Yeah.
generally. That's a good shout. I guess.
I mean I suspect because they use the vignetting, it's just how Dunk remembers it.
I mean, was Dunk outside the room looking?
I mean it's the spirit of the memory, isn't it? Like he everything about him, like, 'cause I'm guessing Arlen Pennytree was to be honest just really quite I don't know, like subpar or whatever. Like I'm kind of getting the feeling that like Dunk idolizes him in a way that isn't perhaps truly reflective of who he genuinely was.
It made me die laughing when Egg was like, "Was he a shit knight?" That kid's really the actor
I
playing
really
Egg
love
is
Egg.
Yeah.
Fantastic. He's so good.
Yeah, there were so many good bits from Egg. And actually, to be honest, one of the shortcomings of the first episode was that there wasn't enough Egg. Like, honestly,
Yeah,
that I don't know what
definitely.
that kid's. Not only is his stage presence great, but also his chemistry with Dunk as well.
I mean, that's the thing, is this series would immediately fail if they couldn't get on cast chemistry between those two characters. That's just an essential core part. And I think like almost everyone that I have nor talked to about it so far has agreed that this episode, by sheer quantity of egg, is a huge improvement. I do feel like I respect the first episode for really taking those slow moments to like do scene setting, and like establish like character body language and establish exactly the place where we're going to be for the next couple of episodes. But like I did in really increase like enjoyed the increase in pace, the percentage of which that time was spent with Egg, percentage of which was spent on like active actions rather than just scene setting. So much of the last episode was set on like, let's go to this place. Well, this one was a lot more like, okay, I need this to happen, so I'm going to talk to this person and this person and this person. And also it helps that the episode by nature is, shorter. So all of that feels a lot more like condensed and interesting. But yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. This episode was fun.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we did have a couple of we did have introductions to other Targaryens.
Yes, we know who the dingus is. God, what a butt! He only had two lines, and I was like, wow.
Yeah, it's Maekors and Baelors, and I. You know what? I'm going to actually. Will IMDb have the cast list? Because I the Maekors and the Baelors.
It would.
I feel like it's not quite as bad as the need for a family tree as House of the Dragon, but I would a little bit of a this is your active character thing for the Targaryens of this particular age, because it's not simple.
Yeah, yeah.
I did enjoy Aegys when he was like sword fighting with himself, being like, down, you Blackfyre bastard. That would be the villain that you like. That would be like, damn you, Pirate Rogers, or I will defeat you, Lord Vader of his era.
Oh, that's like, that. Not only was that adorable, but then also he switched a little bit to like, I don't know, like to like posh, like oh, quite good fighting, and I don't know what it was.
Great riot. He's like. Great writing today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I do enjoy the fact that combining Egg's very childlike wonder, and he's childlike wonder without it being necessarily like there's childlike wonder without it being whimsical.
Mm.
Like when he's watching the puppet show, it's childlike wonder, and when he's like, you know, sparring on his own, it's childlike joy. But he is naive, but it's not in a whimsical way, and I do enjoy that because it's such a hard balance to get with particularly child characters and child actors, where he is naive to an extent about the way that the common folk work, and obviously he's highly educated as to how the political system work. And he's done something a bit foolish to be where he is, but he's also like he's not completely rudderless.
Yeah, no, yeah.
It's a very difficult thing. And obviously we're operating on the assumption that anyone who's listening to our podcast right now fully is spoiled for who Egg is. And I did find it interesting with the number of like little moments that have set up in this episode. If you know, you know.
Oh, we're not,
know,
hang on.
I don't.
Yeah.
Are people not supposed to know who Egg is?
No, it is meant to be a big reveal, I think. Now, obviously, if you've worked it out, there is plenty of crumbs. Like, there is enough crumbs to make a cake.
I thought it was, like, in the blurb.
I don't think so.
No, I think it's supposed to be...
I think it's meant to be a reveal.
I know, it's such, you know...
It's such common... For us, yeah, it's very...
outside of our bubble. I'm very curious to know how many people are actually watching the show not knowing his identity, because I'm sure that it's probably less than the people that...
I feel like it's kind of
weird. I've been watching with my wife, and she does not know. I haven't told her, so I'm
nice.
Curious to see what her reaction is going to be. So I will report on that.
Yeah,
on that.
I feel like in terms of cultural zeitgeist, because we're so in tune with the general cultural zeitgeist of A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones, it's the equivalent of us watching Star Wars and knowing who Darth Vader is. There are people who can watch Star Wars not knowing who Darth Vader is, and I think like the point is it's meant to be a reveal. It is meant to be a mystery, which as soon as you see the breadcrumbs behind you, you're like, ah, that totally makes sense. But you're not meant to get it beforehand. I would be fascinated, Max, to get the word when the reveal happens, because with all of the shots and everything, like him getting really nervous when he's looking up at the stand and being asked to be taken down for an undunk shoulders, and the reaction when he mentions that he talked to the Targaryens and he's like, oh, it could be a commoner being scared of royals or being intimidated by royals, but it's not. And so I'm so interested to know. I'm so interested to know.
Yeah.
I mean, what did we make of the first sort of insight into the jousting?
I enjoyed it. I thought like it was again. We talked about it last week. It's got a very similar vibe to A Knight's Tale.
Mm.
And there's something that is quite difficult to do, but when done right, is really fun. When historical or fantasy shows capture a real life element of excitement that you can get from a modern event of that kind. And there was a point where, like, between the music and the crowd noises and everything, and, like, the sheer amount of crowd, I don't know how much of it was digitally rendered and how much of it was actual extras, like, the sheer amount of crowd felt very much like a music festival.
Yeah.
And, like, it did capture that sort of energy of excitement really well. I thought the stunt work was really good.
Mm-hmm. I know that this question doesn't really have an answer, but, like, is there, like, an entrance fee to just show up and watch, like, or is it just, like, anyone in the area could just come and watch? Because
it's a good question.
I mean, I'm also slightly interested because how much money does Dunk have? Because in terms of, like, if this was, like, a music festival or a, I don't know, a sports event, and turning up and having, like, going to the food stands or going to the bar or doing all that still costs money. Mm. And we pretty well established that Dunk has almost none. And yet he's been hanging around here for days, eating food, drinking ale, doing all of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So obviously maybe Penitree had a bit of gold on hand. And obviously he's had to sell his horse this session, which was really sweet. Like up until that point.
I think he told the armorer that he had 2 silver stags.
Yeah.
So he's not not high on funds.
It's dragon, stag, and copper, right? Those are the three.
I don't know how many of each go into each, but
I'm sure someone's worked out the inflation ratio.
Yeah. Currency, Wiki of Ice and Fire.
Whatever it is, it's going to make more sense than the Harry Potter currency.
Oh, dear Lord. Yeah. I'm world building for the sake of comedy sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. So we've got, right. One dragon is 210 stag.
Oh, you gods.
That's not a very nice number.
That's mean.
Yeah. And so there's a moon. So 30 moons make a dragon, and 210 stag make a dragon. Those are your 2 silver coins. So your gold dragon is gold, right? That is like the dollar, the pound, the top currency. So yeah, you've got and then you've got your coppers. So there are stars, groats, half groats, pennies, and half pennies. So you have 1,470 stars make a dragon. A half penny on the other side of the scale is 23,520. So,
has anyone else just heard the dial-up noise run through their brain at quite a high volume?
Me too. Yeah, I mean, have these people not figured out base 10?
Yeah,
come on.
It's yeah.
It seems in keeping with things like, you know, shillings and half pennies and how all of that didn't really make any sense,
right?
Yeah, it's obviously based on that system. But a dragon, so it's a couple of dragons would be for a full suit of armor.
Mm.
It'd be like three or so dragons.
When Dunk was talking to the armor, he wanted, what was it, 600 stags?
600 stags, so that would be...
That was for like a basic as well.
3 dragons,
A fancy one.
Well, he didn't do fancy ones. I think it's supposed to, isn't it supposed to be the case that he's very, very, it's like the best armor, but it doesn't look particular, you know, it looks...
It's not flashy.
Yeah.
No fancy fruits or flying pigs. Do you think that the reference to flying pigs was like a reference to dragons? Like at this point, like, he's someone that would be too young to have ever seen a dragon, and to him, it's like just as real as a pig with wings.
I mean,
you know,
that would be a cool reference if that is the case. Good job, writers.
Yeah, because I
had not thought of that.
I think we established last time that there was no real person alive that's seen a dragon.
Well, the elderly, but like none of the common folk would know.
Yeah, well, and if anyone's, like, there was some surviving, like, twisted dragons, wasn't there, that lived.
Yeah.
After the Dance of Dragons. There might be someone who's seen something that looked like a, you know, an overgrown lizard. Either way, they would be very old, and it wouldn't have been like a dragon. It would have been a...
Well, that would have been, I don't know, what, like 70 or 80 years ago?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a situation of no one. Because, like even with Aemon Targaryen, who died at 100, like, that was phenomenally rare. So, yeah. I don't know. And also, they would have had to have been in a position to see a dragon anyway. So that narrows it down a lot. So, I don't know. It's basically... And then would they have been too young to really have remembered it?
Yeah, I think the likelihood of someone seeing a dragon at this point is really... Like, it is that sort of level of... It's mythic.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely mythic.
And I enjoy the fact that, like, if we're talking about, again, similar allegories to the jousting to modern life, if the knights who are participating in the joust are the equivalent of, like, sports professionals.
Yeah.
I like the idea that this concept of these guys who are going to win the joust, who have fancy armor and are physically skilled and everything else, if they're the kind of celebrities or the idols of the time, like, if dragons are gone, then, you know, the new gods are these sportsmen, these knights. Yeah. And so it's kind of, it's a level of, you could take into the metaphor of a level of, like, celebrity worship, which I think is a bit of what... It's interesting that Dunk's kind of visual revelation about seeing the joust is more about the idea of, you know, they're really cool, but my guy was a true knight. Also paired with death, and not a level of, like, I think Egg's kind of reaction to it was a bit more, like, hero worshipy. I don't know. It's very interesting seeing all those different facets, because it is, you know, it's men playing at war. That's what a joust is. It is also this kind of sportsmanship thing.
Yeah. I mean, also, it is mentioned that, I don't know, is it mentioned or is it just sort of, like, understood that because Targaryens don't have dragons anymore, they have to be seen as political movers and shakers? Was that not mentioned in the... scene where Dunk's eavesdrops on them?
I think Maker is complaining that their father is forcing them to attend this tourney.
Yeah.
Because, I guess, to keep up appearances.
Yeah. And I guess things like that also...
Can we talk about that scene where Dunk is eavesdropping on the Targaryens? And
yeah.
I thought that was really good. It showed us... You know, definitively drew the characters what's it, Baelor and Maker.
So Baelor is the, like, he is the main guy, I think, right? Like, he's the
he's the heir to the throne, hand of the king.
Yeah,
he's a good man. He knows people's names.
Yeah, and then, remembers Sir Arlen Pennytree.
And then, yeah, and then Maker is...
He gives Dunk the time of day.
Yeah.
When his brothers and everyone else in the room is like, why are you listening to this guy?
Although, I don't know, Maker just seems like he'd just rather be anywhere else.
Yeah, he's just like the grumpy uncle.
Yeah. Although, like, he, you know, because two of his sons are missing, right? So they were the two that we... Well, there's one of them is Egg, and the other... Is the other one at the...
The other one was the drunk.
The drunk at the
thing. At the beginning.
Yeah.
Darren.
That's it, yeah. And was he supposed to be fighting? He's supposed to be...
He was supposed to be fighting, and Egg was supposed to squire for him.
He gone and went drunk.
Whoops. So
he didn't want
to. Didn't want to.
Well, presumably he was... he got drunk and decided that he didn't want to joust... or potentially dragon dream reasons, because didn't he say something along the lines of, I dreamt about you? Again, I know a little bit of the source material. I've not actually read the books, but I think that's something I'm aware of. That he, part of his use and alcoholism comes from the fact that he's got the classic I dream of things thing.
So
Mimi says hi.
Oh, bless.
Hi, Mimi.
just woke up. Anyway, sorry. Oh, yeah. Sorry, the interruption from the black cat.
No worries. We do have Plumber, of course, there in the background, but he doesn't really do anything. He is credited for this, but he literally doesn't say anything. I think he murmurs something at some point.
Yeah. He's a lot less gross than he was in episode one. He's like upright and standing and not like coughing and spitting.
Well,
I suppose that, again, another symptomatic thing of the difference in class thing. Like, I enjoy, like, adding the Targaryens in the front adds another tier. Like, every time we've had small folks, we've had hedge knights, we've had lords, now we have royalty, and we've also got the Kingsguard. Yes. Like, all of that is, you know, they're all stepping stones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we do meet two and a half of the Kingsguard.
Yeah.
Nice armor.
Nice armor, yeah.
It wasn't until...
Yeah, really cool looking.
It wasn't until I think it was the Alt Shift X video, or whatever, where it was explained how many different Kingsguard uniforms there had been. In Game of Thrones alone, there was like, I don't know, I want to say like six different Kingsguard armors.
Yeah, I specifically don't watch the Alt Shift X videos until after.
Yeah,
I've done this so that I'm not too influenced, because he's a smart dude with a lot more knowledge than I am. But I was discussing the different Kingsguard armors back in the day, because it was different under Rob than it was under Joffrey, and then I think they changed it again when it was under
Tommen.
Yeah, under Tommen, and then it was different again under Cersei, and then I think she might change it twice or three times. I think she just kept updating it. And I think there was an update also between Rob to Joffrey. Potentially there was when there was kind of a... I don't know. I think I'd have to watch
Also,
I'm sure he breaks it down better than I'm doing
also,
it. But I definitely remember us discussing it.
Also, we see the armor in the flashback, Bran's flashback as well. We see a Kingsguard armor there. Arthur Dayne wears it. And then, of course, there's the Kingsguard armors that we see in
House of the Dragon.
House of the Dragon, which I think is only the one, if I'm not mistaken. But because they don't seem to change it, do they? I think because in House of the Dragon, both of the aspiring monarchs want to keep the continuity. I think that's the vibe I get.
Need to rewatch House of the Dragon to specifically look at it, because obviously there was the whole different crowns, like they were going with slightly different political messaging in terms of visual iconography.
Yeah.
Once the actual split had happened, obviously for the whole of season one, the actual transition post the death of the king was, you know, of course, a couple of weeks. So obviously they're not going to be able to have new armor commissioned by that point. But I'd be interested to rewatch season two and see whether or not I can notice any difference between Rhaena and Millicent. Oh my gosh, I haven't watched House of the Dragon in a while. My brain has just forgotten all the names.
Alicent,
oh my gosh. Much Lemsip.
They probably should change the uniforms just in case there's another twin situation.
Another twin situation.
That doesn't happen again.
Oh, yeah.
Was it Aaron and Aaron? I forget.
Eric and Arik.
Yeah.
I mean, Game of Thrones does love its twins.
Also,
in terms of costume design, I've also just noticed what's it called? The brother, King's heir to the throne's brother guy, the one with the white hair and the beard. He is wearing his clothing is half red, half black, and I think it was part of the code, as I talked about last week, about how Game of Thrones had like a list of rules for their costuming to keep it consistent. I think one of the rules they had was if costumes were half and half, that person is a villain. I feel like I remember that as a thing. I can't remember, like, that could be completely making up, but I feel like at some point, like having high contrast, particularly left to right, high contrast was like a marker of it being someone being like based or villainous. I that could be completely made up.
Are you talking about Maker?
Yeah.
Let me have a look. Let me scan through.
I'm trying to remember. I feel like I'm hoping that's Game of Thrones. That's where that reference is from. But I definitely feel like there's been some costume analysis that I've watched where they pointed out that if you had that split colouring...
So Baylor's in the soul black, and Maker is in...
Is in, like, kind of burgundy red on one side and black on the other?
Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember if that's part of the house codes, but I feel like it might be part of the house codes for Game of Thrones.
Oh, okay.
Mimi's having a scream in the background.
Oh, she just...
Oh, Mimi.
She just dropped a gronk.
She did just use the litter box again. Yes, she did. This is going to be every podcast. I'm so sorry. Anyone who actually listens to this, I'm so sorry if you hear my cat screaming because she's used the litter.
Oh, it's okay. We love her.
Distraction.
We also have a more formal introduction to Tanzin?
Tanzel,
that's it. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
I did like that conversation. And the character chemistry, like, it's a really sweet chemistry between Duncan and her. It's really sweet. It's almost saccharine, but it's nice.
Because Tanzel's the fair maiden of the story.
Tanzel Tootall,
yes. Tanzel Tootall. So, but she, I believe, is Dornish?
I guess so.
Maybe.
I don't actually know how tall the actress is, because obviously the first time we saw her, she was on stage. And the second time we saw her, she was on stilts. Then, like, first time we saw her was on stage, last episode. This stage, she was on stilts for the show.
And then they did a really
interesting shot with her introduction in this episode, where she was stood on stage. But she looked enormous.
Yeah,
like, so tall, but, like, the first couple of shots. And then she stepped off the stage and... I don't know how tall she actually is in comparison to Doug.
I'm going to try and find out. Oh, height. 6 foot exactly.
Oh, she is very tall. Good. The shots were throwing me off.
Yeah. The shots definitely. I know that she's supposed to be tall because she's. They even allude to this into the episode that she's supposed to be like a match for Dunk isn't the right word, but, like, you know, she's supposed to be, you know, the right height for him, as it were. As they, you know, like...
Two of a kind.
Two of a kind, that's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And, like, I think, you know, having the idea that they're both small folk who are tall is, you know, it's a good parallel.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, the chemistry between them is really nicely done. Like, it's just, it's very sweet. It's very, you know, it's understated, but you can see exactly what's going on. Like, you know, the thing about Dunk, as far as we've been able to find so far, is, you know, he's bluntly honest. Like, he'd be a horrible poker player.
Yeah.
And so when you've got someone that is that kind of, simple's not the right word, but that wears his heart on his sleeve.
Mm.
It's, you know, very easy to see when he likes someone.
Yeah. I find the heraldic shield that he has a bit odd, because the colour of sunset isn't like a heraldic colour. So I don't know, but maybe he's not a heraldic...
He's a hedge knight. He's not a noble person, so he doesn't have to... I think one of the things that I haven't talked about it, I don't know if we talked about it on stream, off stream, as part of this, or as another chat. Heraldic colours, a lot of the time, the legislation behind heraldic colours is to do with the ability to reproduce them.
Yeah.
Both cross generation, so from year to year to year, and keeping consistent, but also, you know, if you're going to paint it on your shield, if you're going to have it embodied on your armor, if you're going to paint it on your banners, if you're going to all of that sort of thing, you've got to have the ability to specifically describe it in a way that can be reasonably copied and pasted between different craftspeople, different generations, different materials, like painting it on a shield versus embroidering it on armor, or dyeing cloth or embroidering it on cloth. Yeah. Those are very, very different skill sets from completely different craftspeople. So if all Dunk needs, at least at present, is a shield, then he can be as creative as he likes, because it's, as far as we know, his legacy is literally himself.
Well...
He's a legacy of Pennytree, but he can't take the heraldry of Pennytree because he's not a direct blood relation.
Yeah, well, exactly.
He can
Yeah,
do whatever he wants with it. If the only thing that's got to carry his crest is his shield.
yeah.
And there's no, like, he's not going to, you know, at least at this point, he's never going to think about having a castle with, you know, his bed sheets embroidered in his own sigil, or having aspects of the sigil, like, you know, engraved on his balustrades.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's so far beyond his scope, budget, and, you know, status, that he can have as much fun as he wants with it.
Yeah.
Particularly when he's talking to someone who is very creative and good at painting, who presumably has access to all the colours he wants.
Yeah. I mean, the tree and the shooting star are quite heraldic in style.
Mm.
But yeah, I think you're right. This isn't like an armorial achievement. It's just literally a device on your shield, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, I did enjoy the fact that Egg was the one that suggested the tree, and then kind of they pull it back the star. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Egg would know a good heraldic thing that would be, like, obviously he doesn't know Dunk very well, but, like, there was a connection as they sat underneath the tree. There was the mm-hmm. comments on being a hedge knight. But also a tree is a perfectly good value image.
Yeah.
Without it's, like, Egg knows what heraldry is taken.
Yeah. Also, it's occasionally mentioned that, like, the devices used, like the tree and the shooting star, like, it's quite humble imagery, right? Like, when mm-hmm. you compare it up against the lion, or even the stag, or the dragon, or the wolf, or octopus, you know, all of these, like, you know.
Like beasts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, it's you know, you do get your tullies with your fish, your beesbury with your bees. I mean, I don't know.
And you also have, you know.
Tyrells are just flowers.
Yeah, Tyrells are roses. Or, like, the other thing to take into account is there are, you know, lesser houses that do get mentioned but less talked about, which have more basic designs, things like black and white chevrons, or you know, all like
Castaways.
That sort of thing. So, like, I think in order for him to be someone without a noble house behind him, he's genuinely got to choose something that, you know, will stand against copyright law. Like, you know, I think Egg suggesting, I think we don't know of many, I think there's House Blackwood. I think that's the only one I think of that has a tree that's one of the noble houses. Or Ironwood, there's one wood one. And then obviously there's the Knight of Laughing Tree, which is multiple generations down the line.
Yeah.
But like the idea that Egg would be able to, we've talked about this. Like, Doug is naive to political life. Egg would be like, let's make sure it doesn't anger a lord in the future. Let's make sure that you're not taking someone else's copyright, and making sure that you're not, like, going with something that could, any other lord could then claim, you know, this hedge knight has stolen my family's colouring or my family's icon. Yeah. So, like, come up with something unique but also identifiable.
But also the laughing tree is not, you know, that's not a full armorial achievement, you know, a house's coat of arms.
It's an unnamed knight, isn't it? It's the, you know, they don't know who he's from. And also, you know, between the new gods and the old gods, a tree is a nice sort of, it's a safe bet. It's a safe bet, but it's got creative energy, and I like it. I like the concept, but I like to see what it looks like when it's done. Hopefully she sands down that shield and, like, treats the wood before she paints on it. Because I was looking at that surface and I was like, oh, that's not going to take paint very well. It's a bit battered.
Yeah, I was thinking that, yeah.
Like, it needs a good touch-up before you start painting on it.
I would not want to use that shield to protect myself against a lance.
No. Maybe it's got reinforcement behind the things. Also, it's interesting that in the next scene, he's got a shield on. It's not a shield with the crest on, but it's just a general shield. So presumably he has plain backup ones and only can only afford for one of them to be painted, and then has one or two spare ones, I'm guessing.
Yeah, when I saw that, I wasn't sure if that was a continuity error. But you said that, I guess that didn't have the
It doesn't have the cup on it. My guess is he can only afford to have one of his shields painted, and then obviously all of the knights who have a big, big budget behind them and like family legacies and whatnot have multiple lances and multiple detailed decorative shields, while he can only afford one painted shield, and then the shield he's wearing on his back for the rest of the episode is equivalent to my emergency backup.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about this either, actually. I'm just trying to find the scene now.
So you're talking about from about 20 minutes onwards, when he's talking to the
Steely Pete.
Smith.
Yeah.
And then when he's giving away his horse.
So I'm going to just try and see. Oh, yeah, that is definitely a blank shield. That's not the same shield.
No, but it's got the same like details in the silver clips at each corner. I'm assuming it was made by the same blacksmith or by the same armorer as the other shield, the one he gave to Tanzel, because the detailing is really the same, but it's not painted. So I'm guessing it was Penny Tree's backup.
Or, yeah, something like that. Yeah, that's definitely not the same shield.
No.
I thought that might be a continuity error, but I now don't think it is.
I'm just skipping through a little bit in the scene where Egg gets annoyed with a bug being in his drink. if you were wondering whether or not he's lowborn or not. But yeah, I did the scene where he's saying goodbye to his horse, and earlier the scene where he's nice to the horse who belongs to the Targaryen Fitzling. I enjoyed those two scenes as, again, like good character work for Doug. Yeah. He is nice, he is sweet-tempered, and he's nice to animals, which is, we were talking, or at least I talked about last session, the kick the dog or rescue the cat, and him being nice to horses is a very, very classic rescue the cat. He's nice to animals. Let's be kind to this sweet boy.
My favorite scene in the whole show was I think it was a step before that, where it was around the Cider and the Fly one, where it's where Dunk says, everyone always told me I was stupid, and then things like and
when is that? I did like that. That was a great. Oh, it's just before the tug of war scene.
Yeah, about 19 minutes in, just before. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's a little bit of just the chemistry in that scene that was particularly amusing.
Yeah, and then the new fan favorite character comes in, Lionel Baratheon.
Yeah, the tug of war was really. It's just such good fun.
Yeah.
So apparently with this scene, health and safety told them to not do it for real, but they did it for real anyway.
you get that many boys in one field.
Well, I don't know if there's a miscommunication or they were just having a laugh or whatever, but like, but it does look it does look like it's real. Like, I don't, how do you even, like, Egg is like... Fake? Yeah, how do you even fake that? Especially when Egg's climbing up on the rope and everything.
Well, presumably it'd be the equivalent of pulling your punches, where they're all like pretending to pull really tightly, but just basically supporting the rope. But it would have been less effective, I think, if they hadn't gone for it. Did I ever tell you guys about, we did a team building thing at work 7 years ago. And we did a bunch of like children's sports day activities. And some of the staff at my place at that point had been there. I think one of the participants had been working in my place for 47 years. And the tug of war, my boss took his tow rope that he uses to drag things off the back of his car, assuming that a tow rope that could pull a, you know, trailer would be strong enough for a tug of war. Not counting the fact that obviously that's not usually counterforce. And the rope snapped, and one member of staff ended up with another member of staff's elbow in their ribs, and ended up with some cracked ribs.
No. So,
it wasn't the best team building day, but it definitely the enthusiasm for the rope to snap.
Hang on a minute. So that I get, so if you're towing a car, if a car is towing something, mm-hmm. I get that that's, there's the
it's all going, the force going basically in the same direction.
Yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
only thing that's carrying back is the weight, which if it's on wheels, it's not like attractive force. It's just kind of pulling it along.
It's just friction, yeah.
Well, if you've got, I think it was like a 8v8 full body weight, including some younger, not small boys, go in for it. It snapped. the rope snapped.
Was it good rope?
it was good enough rope for hauling a car. I wouldn't say it was new? A tug of war rope, it turns out.
Is it? Did it look new? Did it look well worn?
I don't think it was worn at all. I think it was just the counter strength, like the equivalent of, you know, two cars going into each other is going to have double the momentum than one car going into another car. You know, pulling two forces pulling against each other deliberately is going to have a much greater force than one thing dragging the other.
Yeah.
But yeah, the rope snapped. But I will say that the enthusiasm from, particularly again, the younger lads for tug of war was, until the rope snapped, very enthusiastic.
Hmm.
You know, you put people to the challenge, they're going to go for it.
Before the rope snapped, did it look like there was going to be a clear winner, or was it like pretty neck and neck?
I think the actual pulling only lasted for maybe 10 seconds.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it was, but it was, again, enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
A great swell of enthusiasm. So I can totally see how, you know, we've got 8 or 9 fully grown men.
Mm.
Being told, pretend to pull this rope as hard as you can. They're going to go for it. What's they going to go for it?
Yeah.
So apparently, according to the Wikipedia article, I'm trying to find like rope guidelines for this, but apparently lowering one's elbow below the knee during a pull is known as locking and is a foul.
I mean, I don't know whether
or not. I didn't know. Is this regulation?
Apply to Westeros.
This is official tug of war, and apparently,
can they play in the Olympics?
Used to. The highest governing body is the Tug of War International Federation.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's got.
They should bring that back to the Olympics.
They should do. I mean, it's great. Yeah.
Rewatching that scene in silent in the background, mm-hmm. Lord Baratheon's tap on Dunk's ass as he went back to paying was very like we talked about how there was a lot of possible sexual tension in the last episode. Just that bromanship, I appreciate this. I think this is going to be a bromance for the ages. And to be honest, one of the other things I'm getting from watching this in silence is I hope that this is a popular enough show that some of this character work gets put into GIF searches, because just watching all of Egg's like facial expressions and body language, I want to have those as reaction GIFs to so many conversations. Like, I feel like having that sassy little bold kid just rolling his eyes, or like him doing the tug of war, like would be a great like, how's your Friday going? response, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think judging from the scene as well, I don't think they make it super obvious, but Dunk's kind of carrying the team.
Oh yeah,
he's the anchor.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a few. I mean, no one looks close to his size on it.
I mean, they've got a girl on their team as well. They've got a girl and they've got Egg on their team.
Does Egg count as a team member?
I don't know.
Or are they like, just...
I feel like...
I don't know how much difference he was making.
I feel like Lord Baratheon basically was just like, can I create like the opposite team, which clearly has some Tullys in because I see a golden rose, is made out of like bro men.
You mean Tyrell?
Tyrell, sorry. I said Tully, didn't I? Mm-hmm. The Tyrell side seems like all like proper like knightly men and proper like adult squires. And the Baratheon team seems to be mostly joke casting except for himself and Dunk. Like, all the rest seem to be like, do you want to play about it? You'll be fine, right?
Well, yeah. Oh, you're right there, Jenny. The cold coming
yeah,
in.
Good. Yeah, a little bit. The chili helped quite a lot.
Mm. It does. It clears out the cobwebs, doesn't it? Who is the... Just to go back towards the beginning, who's the like, snotty Targaryen?
Aerion. Is he the oldest of Baker's kids? He's one of... He's not... I think Darren's the oldest of Baker's kids. He would be the second oldest with Aemon and Aegon being...
Aerion, Bright Flame. I don't know why he's called Bright Flame. I'm sure there's a reason.
I think he came up with that name himself, is the lore.
He
wears like flamboyantly bright colored like armor or something in a book or something.
I am enjoying. I don't know how much of it is deliberate, but in terms of the Targaryen casting, mm-hmm. most of the Targaryens that we've seen so far look a lot more. I don't want to use like mixed blood or like they don't look Targaryen as we've seen them. They don't look as inbred. They're not all these elven featured, white haired dudes. They're a bit more dark haired, a bit more red haired, a little bit more blonde haired, a little bit more kind of
diverse.
Baelor and Maker's mother was Dornish.
Baratheon. Oh, Dornish. Okay.
Because she's Martell. Because
that's how they were brought into the fold, right? With marriage.
Yeah, that's how Dorne was brought into the Seven Kingdoms, I guess.
Dorne has only been part of the Seven Kingdoms for about 20 years, I believe, at this point.
Sounds about right.
Something like that.
So there's still some sort of I don't know if animosity is the right word, but there's a newness to it all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoy that fact, and they look a bit more kind of grizzled and down to earth. And a lot of, obviously, House of the Dragon, they all look, very white-haired, very regal, very, as I said, kind of elven, fine-featured. Mm. And then by the time we get to House of the Dragon, Lord of the Rings, my God, not enough caffeine in my brain. By the time we get to Game of Thrones, it's pretty much just Dany and her brother, and they seem to be... Suddenly, the genetics have gone way back up the spiral. But I am enjoying that this is an age without dragons, and the Targaryen dragons look much more normal.
Yeah,
it's less other.
Yeah, honestly, I find the dragons an interesting concept, but for the most part, it doesn't move the needle for me. It's good character moments that are, or even good plot and all of the rest of that. To be honest, I mean, I can't wait for season 3 of House of the Dragon though, because that left us one hell of a cliffhanger, didn't it?
Yeah, as I said, I did enjoy the fact that the Targaryens that we've seen so far in this series seem so much more grounded, and political, and intelligent. I'll be interested to see, I believe, and again, not necessarily wanting you guys to confirm either way for the sake of spoilers, I believe that potentially Bloodraven might turn up at some point during this series, and I'll be interested to see what he looks like and how his character is presented.
I mean, I don't know about this season, but I think he definitely appears in the Duncan Egg books.
I think he appears in this story of the Duncan Egg books, and then turns up again later, I think. It's right at the end, if I'm correct.
I cannot remember.
I
don't want it to be confirmed just in case I'm completely wrong, but again, because he's got that sort of mythic Targaryen otherness as a character, I think it'll be interesting to see how he contrasts with this very less other version of the Targaryens.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember the deal with Lionel Baratheon, to be honest. So I'm not going to talk more about how I don't know that for the sake of spoilers.
You're just going to not know it because you don't know it. It's fine.
Yeah,
I don't know
either. I've forgotten more of this than I thought I would do, so...
That means you can enjoy the journey a bit more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the thing is, do you know what we're building up to, Jenny?
The melee that you've talked about a couple of times.
Okay, yeah, because I worry that I see this is one of those things where I've sort of assumed that people know what this the finale is, and I don't want to say too
much. As long as we don't spoil if there are like the outcome, then I think we should be okay. I think it coming to a big melee, I think, is a perfectly adequate kind of predictable solution to a horny story.
Yeah.
Regardless of the circumstances to get there, I don't think, as long as we don't spoil the outcomes.
All right, let me say that there is tournament based action, and however, the stakes rise. The yes. stakes are raised. So, as you would expect, like, see, the thing is, the big finale, as it were, it's one of those things where the finale itself, yes, it'll be like a typical, you know, climax of a Game of Thrones story. But it really is about the journey getting there that's by far and away the most interesting, and the politics that maneuvers everyone to get to those places. I'm just failing to remember, and I feel I really should know, but I don't, where Lionel Baratheon sort of falls in the game.
The sake of not spoiling you and or other people, I won't guesses based on my tangential memory.
I mean, I love his character, and I'm enjoying his on-screen time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, and again, this does remedy a lot of the issues we had with the first season of House of the Dragon, where this is the other end of the scale. This is a lot more, you know, has a lot more levity and is...
The visual comedy and the comedic timing of a couple of these moments are so good. Not just the banter between Egg and Dunk, but like even him like awkwardly not knowing his way out of the castle after sneaking in to talk to the Targaryens, and him literally doing a Gandalf, which is the way, bit as he shuffles left and right to find his way out. Mm-hmm. And the princess or the lady who is the lady of this particular group that's hosting them.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, what are you up here?
And you're big and stupid.
You're big and stupid. Like, just like little moments like that. The levity is so refreshing and it's so needed. And like, I didn't necessarily need, you know, the first sequence of this episode or the first sequence of the previous episode. Like, I think those ones, they're funnier than the cock jokes that were prolific through the last couple of seasons of Game of Thrones, where, like, it was just not very witty banter. At least this was like full visual gags, but not really my particular type of humor. But I do really enjoy like the visual, like body language gags, and the like levity and the genuine banter between characters.
Yeah,
it's delightful. And I really enjoyed, like, again going back to the scene where he walks to the Targaryens. Behind him is a seven-pointed star in the window. And then behind all the lords, there's a mural above the fireplace of like naked ladies. Hang and on. It's just, it. There's a lovely visual dichotomy between him.
Where are these naked ladies?
They're in the stone carving above the fireplace. And okay. I find that really like a delightful, like subtle, but really well done visual gag between who's got the kind of moral upper hand. This bumbling guy who can't find his way out versus the lords who've got naked ladies above their fireplace. It's just, it's like little things like that are just endlessly brilliant to me.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if only I noticed that, then that's fine. I'm okay with that. But hopefully other people can get it as well. I need
playing it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, I really love the chairs they're sat on during that sequence. The carved wooden chairs are so medieval, core, beautiful. And I kind of want them, except I know them to be uncomfortable as chairs in general.
Another thing I loved about that scene is the master of games, just his silent, you know, reactions and his looks to Dunk
are, being like, oh god, great. This guy again.
Yeah, I Also, I think
the costuming's great. I just have to point out. Once every episode, I'm going to point out how good costumes are. But I love the new Hand of the King kind of clasp that's used to carry the cape. That's how they elongated it to match the kind of serpent tails that are wrapping around the back of his costume.
Oh right, okay, yeah.
Because we're in a different generation of Game of Thrones, every time they bring in a new fashion quirk of the era, that's really fascinating to me. And the fact that these guys have got a very sort of, I don't know, it's kind of, it's very angular type brooches. They've got lots of like long brooches that kind of almost work like chains, but they're brooches.
Mm.
Maelor's got ones which kind of look more like, his have got like peg toggles to tie up the front of his surcoat, but they're very long and pointed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to point out, at least once an episode, I've got to point out how good costumes are.
Yeah, because I will also point out the fact that the Game of Thrones world is one of the very few worlds where people look like they live and exist in the environment.
Because mm-hmm.
there are so mm-hmm. many fantasy in a lot of fantasy, people just look too clean, for one. Mm. The clothes don't look worn. They look, you know, and they'll have stuff that is just like, you know, there'll be a costumey element to so much of it. And this has never been the case with Game of Thrones. And it's always something that I appreciate on a level, like, it really matters. Like, there's, and you know, it doesn't make or break anything. You know, there's stuff like what was the other one, Wheel of Time, where a lot of cases that it had I think there were plot reasons for it, but it felt very much more like a video game level of fantasy, whereas this feels like
I talked a lot about this in the last podcast. So I don't want to repeat myself too much. I just we'll put it in the bingo cards. Once every podcast, I've got to point out one costume quirk that brings me infinite joy. Yeah. And I will stick to try and point out only one thing per episode that I'm like, oh, and that one for this one was definitely the Hand of the King brooch and how that stylistically matches with the other Targaryen jewelry that we've thus far seen.
I
really try and keep it to one thing first.
That Jenny's fashion corner one every episode. that bit with the fish, when he goes, that bit with the fish was disgusting. That one always tickles me, just at the end of the episode there.
Yeah, well, I also enjoyed the fact that obviously the generation of Tullys in Game of Thrones,
they're
all quite self-serious and a bit dour and a bit grim. You know, Catelyn obviously has her issues, and then you meet the Blackfish and her dad's dying and their sister's wackadoo. So, you know, meeting Tullys who are there for the showmanship and for the fun is so, like, I don't feel like you'd get them, like, it's another symptom of the change of tone for this series. And also, speaking perhaps to the state of the world that it currently is, that, like, people are watching the jousting and lords and knights are doing kind of fun is more happening. It felt so out of character for the Tullys that we know, but so in keeping with this generation of the world.
Yeah.
And it felt very like, you know, they are the celebrities, they are the sportsmen or the rock stars of this era. It felt a little bit like, was it Marilyn Manson biting the bat off? Biting the bat head off?
I think it was Ozzy Osbourne, but I believe Alice Cooper may also have done something like that.
Yeah, so it is that sort of like the crazy type thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The world building in only two episodes that sets, I think, because between Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, so much of the core essentials of the world are built. This can focus on building out the characters and the era which it's in, rather than having to explain about what Targaryens are and who the king is and who the Hand of the King is. And because it's small focus, well, it doesn't matter if you don't know that stuff anyway. So you can focus on the vibe and how the story makes you feel.
Mm.
And that's nice. I like it.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Um, Yeah. I think if there's anything else we haven't talked about yet, or I haven't ranted on that for way too long, you guys do have the right to tell me to shut up, Ed.
No, it's all good. Not really anything to add. Gwyn, is it Gwyn? Yeah, Gwyn. I don't think she's really mentioned in the books. I think they give her a little bit more, not much more, a little bit more here.
You're talking about the girl in the castle?
That's the one, yeah. But
yeah, I didn't pick up on her name during the episode, actually. But she's given more to do here, you say?
Well, I mean, the tiniest bit more. This is the reason, I believe, isn't it her birthday or something? That's why they're having the tournament.
Right, yeah, that's the excuse they have for the tourney.
But, you know, obviously, as we can see through the episode, no one cares. Like, it's a tourney for tourney's sake, right? Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tourney for tourney's sake. It's a tourney for, you know, bringing together lords. Like, all of the political stuff, like distraction, like keeping the peasantry happy, you know. There's a lot of things that a tourney produces through secondary default, which, you know, can be useful or not so useful for lords.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of sequences we have or have not talked about. Have we talked really much about the opening montage of Elitri and Doug's kind of things? There isn't that much to say other than...
I touched a bit on it. I did like seeing all the, like, they do jump around to a lot of locations in the flashbacks, and I appreciate that you get to see, like, a whole, like, relationship, like, pretty very quickly and not with a whole lot of words exchanged. You get to see the feeling that Dunk has towards
his How do we master. Think Pennytree got his arm injury that presumably killed him? Injury that presumably got sepsis, because I assumed in the first episode that he'd gotten some sort of stomach illness, which in a man of his age was more deadly than in a man of Dunk's age, and that's why Dunk had his pre-incident, was that they both had the same thing. And just Dunk being young and healthy was able to survive it, but Pennytree wasn't. But now it's pretty obvious that Pennytree died of some form of sepsis, which it keeps with the theme of Khal Drogo and his death by injury and slowly kind of, you know, infection. But
it also maybe is part of the whole, like, sort of, I don't know, like, commentary or like the touching on class aspects, because if he was, like, you know, a knight of a wealthy house, then he might have been able to see a maester that could have, you know, treated his wound
medicine
before it got infected and killed him.
And obviously the episode itself is called Hard Salt Beef, and it has them eating hard salt beef in the first scene, and then him having hard salt beef at the end of the last scene. And that obviously is a hard-wearing travel food that not necessarily lords would interact with, but also I suppose implies there's a level of, like, firmness of will and character.
Is it like a jerky or a dried meat?
Yeah, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Sort of like heavily salted, fortified travel food, which, you know, you need to properly get your teeth in order to eat.
Yeah, yeah. Keeps the teeth sharp.
But, like, I find it interesting that, like, for the name of the episode, obviously it bookends either end of this episode, but is it just speaking to, you know, Duncan being like the salt of the earth, or that he's hard wearing, or that he just, you know, that's the legacy that he remembers, sharing meat underneath the tree, is what he wants to carry forth. I don't know. I feel like it's a good name, but other than bookending either side of the episode, it doesn't speak.
I think it's just the metaphor of it all, isn't it? Like, you know, it's practical over comfortable, I guess, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the idea that Arlen Pennytree was, you know, he was like it, you know, like, you know, a bit tough as old boots, you know, no frills, that kind of thing, I guess.
Mm.
One thing I did actually quite like, but you don't see this in Heraldry as well, is the Ashfords, House Ashford has orange, has an orange field, which is not a heraldic colour, but, I mean, Game of Thrones, isn't it? They've made it heraldic colour.
Yeah. Well, they're not like a high house, are they? So they can have probably a little bit more flexibility than top nobles.
I mean, if they're a house that's hosting tourneys, then I'd imagine
they've got
so.
Enough money.
But then the Kingsguard guy's like, is there a proper place to shit here? And so not maybe really. It's not. Maybe it is a bit more rural than somewhere like Harrenhal or where else would they have tourneys? Like Highgarden or
Castle Rock
or somewhere like that. Yeah, where they'd have you know, much nicer facilities, maybe.
It seems like quite a large castle, but it also seems somewhat primitive. Amy's walking on my keypad, so I'm sorry if the audio cut out. She's like, I am the star of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, I mean, I can only imagine, really, that's just something, that's a Game of Thrones thing, really. Maybe because there's a lot of houses and they want more. You know, George R. R. Martin might want more visual ways of having them stand out, or I don't know, maybe he just wants to expand the heraldry in the world or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, would you describe that colour as like gold or like rusted red?
Oh,
you would describe it in the books.
So with heraldry, I don't think it can be, because with heraldry, you have two colors. You have a metal and you have a fabric color. So a metal will either be white or yellow, and then the fabrics will usually be green, blue, red, black, I think.
We know that Game of Thrones then is already breaking the rules, because House Dane is that one's the one with like purple,
yes. I'm not entirely sure how the colour of purple fits into heraldry, because it does have royal connotations, but I don't know how that... So I don't know that there. Also, Targaryens technically break the rules, because they have two... they have black and red, but no metal. And in my head, I've been like, oh, well, they're counting dragon glass as a metal.
Mm.
So that kind of makes sense. Like, especially,
yeah, I can see that.
You know... so yeah, I think with Game of Thrones, this is just like they've added more colours to heraldry. Yeah, I guess, you know, there's no reason why it doesn't make any sense, especially considering that in Game of Thrones, that in the world of Game of Thrones, they seem to have more access to more colours, like dyes and things like that. Like, it's a more colourful world than an actual real life history.
Well, that one's a bit questionable when you talk to particularly medieval historians.
Mm.
So I can't remember what the term is, but there's a psychological effect when we look at things that have aged by modern times and imagine that in their when it was current times that they looked as what they look like now for us. And I can't remember what the technical term for that is, but things like most Roman statues were painted.
Yes.
Most Roman statues were in bright colours. Heraldry, when it first died, was quite vibrant, and things like murals and stained glass windows and mosaics would have been very bright and colourful. But when you think about them in terms of what we think of as colour and what we think of as what we see them now, we think of Roman statues being all... hailstone. We don't think of them in colour. And it's particularly prolific when we think of the 20th century, when we think of the Victorian era being like black and white.
Yeah.
Like there's or like the 70s being sort of
sepia
brown tones. Yeah. Sepia tone, yeah. If you talk to particularly medieval scholars or Tudor scholars, they will say that, like, the world was not monotones. It was brightly coloured. It was painted. It was vibrant. And I think famously, I think within the last 5 years or so, one of the big Scottish castles did a massive renovation where they redressed all of the rooms to look and feel as they would have done during medieval times. Yeah. Not medieval times, the thing. And apparently loads of people were really put off by it because it was really colourful and really bright and vibrant and almost, you know, this sort of technicolour with a lot of clashing colours because medieval people really love their clashing colours.
Yeah.
When we look at tapestries as they are now, they are dimmed, but when they would have been originally done, they would have been in these bright, vibrant dyes. And a lot of historical costumers have experimented with natural dyes to see what colours can come out. And when you do things like beetroot dyes and hemp and henna dyes, you can get these really beautiful, vibrant yellows and reds and golds and pinks. And so, like, our perception of medieval fantasy has been... Well, I wish I remember what the psychological term for it is.
Well, like prejudiced, I guess.
There's a technical term for when we seeing the past through the current era's eyes.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I really appreciate about Game of Thrones is they do let the costumes have colour and let the costumes have a contrast vibrancy. I will say, aesthetically, the world of Game of Thrones is more cohesive and more aesthetically pleasing than a lot of medieval works, like medieval tapestries and their depictions of animals, both real and imaginary. Like if you want a fun time, look up medieval depictions of cats. They're weird. They're so weird. They have human faces. They have like weird body shapes. They're doing strange things. Like you know, and it's not like cats were strange novelty creatures. They were seen every single day. But if you put them into a medieval tapestry, they were weird.
Now, to be fair, faces are hard.
I can never get the nose right.
I will say aesthetically for Game of Thrones, like when they do murals or tapestries, they, for the most part, like are a more realistic the world depiction of the world than tapestries in our reality were our world at the time. But I really like it.
Yeah.
I've forgotten what the actual point is.
Okay, so the dyes.
I was defending the bright colours. I was defending the dyes and the bright colours.
I
can send you some historical YouTubers doing dye experiments as evidence.
You can
get really beautiful colours using natural dyes.
I mean, looking at like beetroot, for example, you could probably get a good dye out of that just alone. In my head, right, and maybe this is just some sort of weird internal logic that hasn't lined up right, is I always assumed dyes would be expensive. But because the thing is, in the world of Game of Thrones, right, like King's Landing will have people who are dressed in more bright colours because they're a trading port, which, again, makes sense and everything like that. And obviously we traded in the UK, but you can probably make some dyes with homegrown ingredients, right?
Yeah, I believe so. I've not actually experimented with it, but it's something that I kind of want to at some point. Some of the stuff that can be done is really beautiful. And the, you know, the caveat to that in Game of Thrones is if you're a high-ranking house whose heraldry is, say, orange, then you would be willing to invest in the trade gold, make sure you always have enough of that particular ingredient if it's not native to your home area. And if it is native to your home area, then more so better, because that's...
Well, it might...
That's where you would design your heraldry to match with what you can readily get available.
Yeah, that second one seems like the more logical one. It's like they would have orange heraldry because there is some plant...
Saffron.
Or I don't know, copper? Can you make copper into a dye?
Copper is a dye.
Copper would turn green over time.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Which I think you can use for dyeing, but I think that would be more effective on... like metalworks and woodworks, as like a, it's one of those things that changes under UV, so it's more an external thing rather than a clothing dye. Yeah. But theoretically, it might be possible. I'm not sure.
I'm just throwing out nonsense, to be honest.
I mean, it sounds like good nonsense to me.
Excellent.
Well, they have all these, you know, fictional plants and stuff. I just assume they have all different kinds of berries and stuff that are colors that we don't have.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what the difference in climate is between us and you, Max, because, I mean, I guess Pennsylvania would have all like a whole different ecosystem. So you might do great at getting oranges, and we might do great at getting purples.
No, you definitely can't grow oranges here.
No, I mean orange the color, not orange the fruit.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure there's tons of plants that, you know, you have that we don't have here, and vice versa.
Although our climates are somewhat similar, right, I think?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, millions of years ago, the Appalachian Mountain Range, you know, the British Isles were, like, a part of it, or, like, next to it geographically.
But you guys get a lot colder winters than we do.
Yes, I think that has to do mostly with ocean currents and stuff, and you guys being an island and whatnot.
Yeah, we've got a nice tidal warming picture. Will not last when global warming hits.
Okay, I've got to run out now. Sorry, an emergency has just arisen.
Oh no!
I've locked Rosie out of the garden, so I need to go and let her in. But this might be a good time to wrap up.
Okay.
Sorry, I know it's a bit.
I'm going to send you a link to a video on natural dye fabrics.
Awesome.
Cool. Or historical stuff for your own reference. But I think the only thing that I'd say that we haven't done yet is talking about how neat the interaction with the.
I'll tell you what. You keep going just for a second, and I'll be back as soon as possible.
Okay. I was finding the interaction with the two Kingsguard really neat in that, like, it gives Dunk this big round of, like, inspiration for how he can potentially climb the ranks of the king, go from being just a hedge knight all the way up to a knight, and then it's revealed that, like, yeah, it's family of crabbers, but also they own a fleet.
Yeah, half the fleet's in Westeros, as Egg said. Yes, like, this, yeah.
Not quite.
It's pretty interesting that Sir Donald presents himself as the son of a crabber.
By comparison, he's new money, I suppose.
Exactly. That's the good way to put it.
There's a quite significant difference between new money that owns a fleet of ships and Dunk, who literally has clothes on his back.
Yeah.
I mean,
it shows you the different perspectives in the class differences.
Yeah. I found that like a really funny bookend to that conversation, because it was, for me, that was a funnier version of the Game of Thrones theme song swelling and then poop like that.
Yeah,
that was funnier. This version was much funnier to have this. Oh my God, I could become a knight of the Kingsguard and raise above my station to become, you know, this lord. And then it's been like, no, his family owns a fleet of ships. Like, it won't happen in your generation. Obviously, spoilers potentially for the future. You know, someone can climb that high. But I just, it was a great rug pull, and I found that, like, genuinely funny. And I don't know, like, I don't know how much of it was intended as a joke in the same way that more obvious humor is in this episode, but I found that so funny.
Yeah, no, I found that very funny too. Yeah,
I definitely think it was intended that way, and I just find it more and more hilarious every time Egg just has like this like knowledge of stuff, and Dunk's like, how do you know that?
He's like, I like stuff.
I like fishing.
Like at some point, I think Dunk's going to find out that Egg can read, and he's going to be so confused.
Like, that'd be good. That'd be for a good scene.
So I can only assume that Dunk is not literate. Like that would be crazy if he was literate. But like, I think, you know, at some point, I think Egg's going to read something to him, and he's going to be like, what?
I think there's going to be like, I find it quite interesting with the dynamic that like, there's very much a one is the brains, one is the brawn kind of situation.
And both of them are the heart. Like both of them are kind of basically well-intentioned, but come from such different places. Yeah, I really enjoyed that Kingsguard interaction because of that punchline.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, if we're talking the Kit the Cat, Save the Dog, the fact that Kingsguard are nice to Doug. Like, if you think of Doug as the dog, when people are nice to the dog, we like them. And when people are mean to the dog, we don't like them. Mm. And it's such a effective and simple exposition action. Now, obviously, this world is probably going to get more complicated as we go. At the moment, this world seems quite simple as the characters we've had presented. And it'll be interesting to see if we get characters that seem to be nice to Doug and then turns out they're not so nice, and how that affects both Dunk's kind of semi-naive perception of the world in relation to...
I don't think this is going to be anywhere near as complex as the Game of Thrones that we're used to.
No, but I'll be interested because we last episode we talked about how Egg, kind of the way that he interacts with the worlds, comes from a position of power and a position of not quite untouchable, but like untroubled. He's not troubled by the world. He can kind of go through the world feeling like the consequences of his actions aren't necessarily going to have negative consequences.
Yeah.
While Doug is very much the opposite of that. I will be interested to, and they're both kind of naive in very different ways. While I'll be interested to see when, because Doug wears his heart on his sleeve, he views people, at least this part of the series, because we're mostly seeing it through his eyes, we see people as kind of a bit more like one-dimensional. Like, if they're nice to him, we're like woo. If they're mean, we're like boo. Once we get more into Egg's perspective, I'll be interested to see whether or not he's more like incisive. Is that a word? He has better insight into people, particularly people with political intentions. I'm interested to see how that dynamic evolves. Because there will be people that are more politically devious, and I think at this point I think it'll be interesting if we get like season 2 and season 3 in particular, if Doug climbs the ranks, as presumably he does,
yeah,
as we do know where this story is ending, as he gets more power, people then try and manipulate him more, because at this point really doesn't get anyone anything to treat him any differently to how they instinctually want to. Like if they treat him meanly, it means nothing. If they treat him nice, it means nothing in the higher political game. But if by season 2 or 3, when theoretically he's kind of climbed the ladder a bit, whether or not people are more devious, and whether or not he needs to learn to see people in a more complex way.
See, this is kind of interesting, because we only get glimpses into the Kingsguard, but they are, in a way, like staff, right? Like service personnel. Yes, their position is somewhat ceremonial, but also like they're there to do a job all the time, and they have when they were talking to the Kingsguard, were talking to Dunk. Yeah, Dunk was a little bit starstruck, but also they were talking to him as like a fellow
swordsman,
more of a fellow, like, I don't know, staff, like, you're here, you know.
I don't know what you're saying, they weren't talking to him like a peasant, they were talking to him like a worker.
Like
downstairs, but part of the same household.
Yeah, because they're kind of workers themselves. Like, yes, they're a very privileged, you know, different class of worker, but they're still there working.
Yeah, you can see that. I think the Kingsguard are an interesting position that hasn't been explored much, which, again, I hope we maybe get into in this season. Because in Game of Thrones, like, there were legendary Kingsguard.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the Kingsguard, you know, you're talking about theoretically the greatest fighters. Like, they have to be incredibly skilled, and ideally from a high prestige household. And obviously in House of the Dragon, they explored what happens when you try and get Kingsguard for the sake of politics rather than the sake of skill. But then what if you hire people for the sake of skill, but for the strong political reasons.
Yeah, like you want, like, I mean, from a class point of view, you might want your Kingsguard to be from the family, the aristocratic families, because their interests align with yours a little bit more. But also there is this, like, people who are brought up in wealthy households, they're going to have like a much better access to education, including swordsmanship and riding and all that kind of stuff. Like your average, you know, peasant is
not going to become a great fighter because they're not going to have that's what was discussed with John at the Wall. Of course, John is the best swordsman in the whole of the Northern Guard because he's had access to Ned Stark's steward and master of arms for his entire life. So of course he's the best swordsman. But also again in House of the Dragon, they've really discussed that with the hiring of what's he called, Fancy Boy,
Crispin Cole.
Who, you know, oh, Mimi's decided to make herself known again. Where his whole thing was he was from a lower household, and so she should have hired, like, when Rhaenyra was looking at increasing the Kingsguard, and she was told, oh, with the guys who are politically able but have never seen a battle, and she was like, no, he's meant to look after my father, he needs to be actually good at fighting. And then she hired a guy who's got, you know, big old bad mental health, bad attitude to women, like, really
probably the biggest mistake she ever made.
Yeah, like she really, like, she hired a guy for his skills, not necessarily for his personality, but like there should have been a third option there. There should have been someone who could have been, like, I don't know how you would review that particularly.
I mean,
I get why she hired him instead of hiring someone.
I don't want to have to stand up for Criston Cole, but like, the guy has some legitimate grievances. Like, if you're a peasant boy and you've been elevated to, you know, your professional dreams have come true. You've got that promotion of a lifetime. And then under the pressure of the royals, your vows are broken and you've been pressured into a scandal.
Well, again, like, if you were to talk about Criston Cole, going
and he just threw it away.
If you talk about Criston Cole in relation to modern place sexual harassment, he was basically victim of sexual harassment in the workplace by his boss. Now, his boss also being, you know, a 15, 16-year-old girl, comes into it somewhat. But, he was a victim of circumstance.
You do have to question his ability to say no, right? Like,
yeah, like, he does have an upstairs brain as well as a downstairs brain. Like, he could have said no.
He could have said no, but he could have got his head cut off, like...
It is
a complicated situation, but at the same time, like,
I mean, he is a victim of workplace sexual harassment
pressure.
It was a perfect example of quid pro quo sexual harassment. You do this, or, well, you know, obviously she never vocalized it, but the threat was innately there.
Well, your vows. I don't know, but your vows is to serve the royal household, so you are in that position where you can't refuse an order. But what if that order goes against, you know, your oath? You're being ordered to get yourself into trouble.
That's the Jaime Lannister thing.
It's
the Jaime Lannister / modern political don't you have the right to refuse illegal orders situation.
Well, like, I mean, we do as human beings after, you know, Nuremberg trials or whatever. But, like, I don't know. They don't have that in Westeros.
Unless they're from a household politically powerful enough to make it work. So, again, Jaime Lannister is the exception that proves the rule because he's from a house powerful enough to just about get him off the hook. For disobeying his orders.
Sort of, I think.
And then maybe taking it one step a bit further.
Okay, I don't know. See, this is where it gets complicated, which again is part of Jaime Lannister's torment, right? Because when you join the Kingsguard, aren't you supposed to like lay down your rights?
Family,
yeah.
Family rights, and yeah.
Claims to land and
yeah. But then wasn't there talk about Jaime Lannister being re-given the title to Casterly Rock?
I mean, basically Jaime Lannister broke all the hecking rules. And he got away with it because Tywin was so politically powerful. He literally broke, you know, all of every single Kingsguard rule you can possibly have. He broke it fundamentally in killing the king. Like that is like the peak of like, you know, there's sleeping with, like breaking your rules by having sex is something that many Kingsguards have done over the years. That's kind of a, it's almost a bizarre, you know, rite of passage for breaking the rules. Mm-hmm. But like actively being the one to stab the king, that's top tier. And the fact that he wasn't executed means like that's crazy. The fact that, you know, he survived, like not only did he kill the king, but then, you know, should he still be a Kingsguard? Should he be allowed to retake his lands and home and title? Should he be allowed to, you know, if he retakes his land and hold and title, then theoretically he can remarry. Well, all of that is not set, like, it's new precedent.
Yeah, but also, I think the thing is as well is, I mean, technically, Jaime Lannister, when he was made Kings, because he was, like, basically forcibly made Kingsguard by Aerys as a slight against Tywin Lannister because he wanted to take...
It's basically a soft hostage.
Well, sort of, yeah. It's like you don't have an heir no more, or like Tyrion's your only heir. Or
Tyrion's your heir, yeah.
So that was the sort of thing about it. But if
becoming a Kingsguard as a hostage is like, again, the sheer amount of novelty regarding Jaime Lannister's Kingsguardmanship is nuts.
Yeah, but also, like, I mean, you can retire from, you know, Kingsguard can be retired. They say it's...
Well, then not a single one's ever been retired until Cersei fires... What's he called?
Barristan Selmy.
Yeah,
which, is that really true? Because are you going to have, like, old Kingsguard right up until they die?
I think you're meant to. I think you're meant to have them right up until they die. And the concept is obviously because there's how many of them? Eight?
Yeah.
Seven. The idea is if you're like, you should cover their age gaps appropriately. So if one of them is like super duper old and frail, then the other seven need to be, you know, young, fit, healthy, and able. And then, you know, kind of get them in like decades, as it were, I assume. So, you know,
a rotation.
Like
the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Because it's a sworn brotherhood for life. I think the fact that like it's absolutely shocking and scandalous that Cersei gets rid of Barristan Selmy, particularly given that she keeps Jaime, like that is beyond politically shocking. That she gets rid of someone who is trusted and still very skilled over the person who literally stabbed the previous king in the spine. Mm. But I believe that is the first time that has happened. Presumably, I would assume if a king really, really, really hated their Kingsguard, then they would get them executed. Yeah, it wouldn't be dismissal, it would be execution. And if they're really old and frail, then you just have to make sure that the other seven can hold up their side.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, also, we have seen cases where... Household guard also, you know, assist in that kind of thing.
Yeah, and presumably most royals will also have their own family, like knight squires, army, whatever. Obviously, the Targaryens up until House of the Dragon were slightly different as well, because Targaryens didn't really even need their Kingsguard all that much when you got actual dragons. Obviously, you know, they show how well they're needed in the time when Rhaenyra gets attacked by the battle between the twins, and it is shown that you can have dragons and still be, you know, attacked in your bed. But she would have had household guards on Dragon's Reach. Dragon's Reach is quite a hard place to get to anyway. The only reason why he was able to get that close is because he's a twin. Like, you would have had, you have castle guards that live and work at your castle. You would have your king's guards that travel with you that are like the elite bodyguards. You would have your, you know, the gold cloaks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in order to get to that top tier, you know, one of them can be the weak link and you still have enough strong ones around you. So yeah, I think it is meant to be a for life thing. I think I can't think of any other examples of Kingsguard being dismissed before Barons and Selmy.
Yeah.
So, you know, if someone does get weak and old and frail, presumably it'll be their duty to either, possibly, I don't know whether or not this is part of the culture. It might be in the same way that you've got the Greybeards from the north.
Mm-hmm.
So when, particularly just before winter, that'll be when they send their old men who want to die a noble death,
mm-hmm.
go out and do battle or go on big hunting trips or such like, and with the intent of them not returning.
Yeah.
I wonder whether or not there's something similar within the King's Guard, where if a guard is really getting towards the end, whether they're sent to oversee a skirmish with the intent of them dying nobly in battle.
Yeah.
That could well be something that I can see happening.
Mm-hmm.
Or they die in their beds in King's Landing, and presumably the other guys have got to pick up the slack.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I really love that punchline, going back to Misapture the show. Yeah. I'm interested, like, bringing in the nobles, bringing in the royalty. Mm-hmm. As much as we've said we've enjoyed it being a small folk story,
mm-hmm.
it's like adding tower, like bricks to the Jenga tower. Like, it's adding another layer, it's adding more. It's not taking away from the foundation that they've already built in the previous episode, but it's just adding more to it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's definitely the thing I'm looking forward to as well. Like, I'm watching Fallout, and I like, you know, the series of Fallout's great so far, but this is the one I'm, like, super looking forward to every week.
Mm-hmm.
Are you caught up on Fallout? I know it's off topic, but...
Yeah, I'm all caught up. Okay. Yeah, I'm really liking it.
I'm excited. The next episode, I think, is the finale. Pretty excited.
Is it finale? Are we already that far along?
Yeah, only 8 episodes.
For my shame, I'm comfort rewatching Supernatural at the moment, so I can't lay any claim to prestige television of any kind. Supernatural is fun for the most part.
I think, to be fair, I think Rosie's getting through Supernatural on a rewatch as well.
Hey, I know when I will burn out on Supernatural. It's usually around season 8 is when I keep wanting to get past the point where I can't stand it, and because I see clips from season 9 through to 15 and they look fun, but there's a point in season 8 where I can't get past some of the really, really stupid. And also at that point is the point where you really can't avoid the lack of female representation, people of color, diversity in general. Like, there's a certain point where you just can't deal with the fact that the entire cast is white men.
my siblings were really into Supernatural. I never really got into it. I watched like the DC CW shows, but that's as far as CW goes, that's as far as I got. The only episode of Supernatural I ever saw was the Scooby-Doo crossover episode.
I never got as far as the Scooby-Doo crossover, but again, that's one of the ones I do want to see, because I think that's like season 11 or something, or season 13. It's quite late in the game. Yeah, they did a genuine Scooby-Doo crossover. They turn into cartoon characters. And this is
I know they get real meta with it in other episodes.
I'd say Supernatural is the most meta show I have ever watched that still somehow manages to claw onto some aspect of internal reality. But honestly, it is like The French Mistake is one of the most fever dream experiences of any episode of any TV I've ever watched ever, and I don't see any other show going as far as The French Mistake goes. That was insane. The French Mistake is the one where they travel to our world and they are playing their actors in the TV show of Supernatural.
Yeah, that's one I've heard a lot about. But yeah, that when I heard that, I'm like, okay, maybe Supernatural is a little bit
too much. like, and that's, you know, it's been part of the canon for a long time. Like, season one has an episode where they, like, go to Hollywood and, like, are basically doing, like, they're posing as EAs on the background of a horror movie. Mm-hmm. And so, like, even from season one, they had the meta commentary, but, like, The French Mistake is season five. No, The French Mistake is season four. And then season five has, like, a one where they, like, mock a bunch of TV shows. They go into different TV shows and, like, mock, like, Grey's Anatomy and CSI. And it's broad. It's broad comedy. And then, like, it got more.
It went for, what, like, 12 seasons? I don't even know. Like,
15 seasons.
Oh, 15 geez.
Seasons. Yeah, I'm in season five, and I'm like, wow, the plots happened a lot. And then I'm like, I'm less than a quarter of the way through. As I said, I get burnout around season eight. Mm-hmm. Season eight is when I'm like, okay, they've killed off the last cool female character that they hadn't been more than two episodes. Okay. Anyway, talking about Supernatural versus, like, as I said, I cannot lay claim to watching prestige TV other than...
Yeah.
I have Seven Kingdoms. There's a lot of better TV shows I could be watching than Supernatural, but it is a comfort show.
Hey, you gotta watch what you gotta watch, right?
Yeah. You know, you can find joy. People still watch Friends.
That's right. No one should be judged on their comfort stuff. I love a bit of RuPaul's Drag Race. That's my little comfort show.
In all fairness, when my sister told me that she really loved Love Island, I was like, okay, boo, you do you.
Love Island's fun. Every once in a while.
It's like, such a commitment, though. It's a
pleasure.
It's like...
It is. You gotta, it's like five episodes or six episodes a week.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
You see, my old housemate used to watch it, so I walked in on her quite a lot watching it, and it was one of the things that I don't think I could watch because the way that my brain processes visual media is way too driven by acknowledging the behind-the-scenes stuff. And there was the episode that I can remember walking in on was they had... decided to shake things up for plot points. They brought in a load of new female contestants, mm-hmm. like mix up the dynamic.
Bombshells.
And the shot was a bunch of new women walking onto the set past the pool in bikinis and high heels.
Mm-hmm.
In slow motion with like party music happening.
That's what they do.
Yeah, Love Island.
All I could hear in my brain throughout the sequence was some poor director or PA behind the scenes going, left, right, left, right, right foot forward. Like, that's all I could hear in my brain because it was a coordinated march and someone behind the scenes must have been choreographing it. And that's all my brain could process. I couldn't process anything that was actually meant to be emotively happening. Like, ooh, look at the sexy ladies walking across by the pool. All I could think was some poor PA in the background trying to get them to walk in some sort of like marching order.
I mean, yeah, I guess so.
This is how my brain works. I'm sorry.
I always like I think it's Saturday they do an episode where it's like a leftovers clips stuff. and I like those episodes because usually during the week you hear about all the romance and the Love Island stuff, but then
the drama.
But on Saturday you get all the clips of them talking about like random shite, like just what they talk about when just
and the cameras are.
Yeah, well, the rest of the day that
the other 23 hours of the day that we
So it's just more normal conversation, and it's I don't know. I find that to be quite interesting. It shows their personality a little bit more, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I I'm not going to yuck other people's yums.
I mean, I'm assuming that your sister did not defend herself.
She did defend herself, and I appreciated her sentiment. Although now she lives in Japan and watches a lot more K-dramas, so every once in a while she'll discuss with me what was happening in her most recent K-drama. Which I will often respond with what I was watching in my most recent historical Chinese drama. So, again, I'm not going to yuck other people's yums. I do not have good enough taste to have a high horse to stand upon.
I mean, that makes all of us, right?
Yeah.
We be human.
Right, anyway, it's getting late for me, so I think, should we wrap this up? But thank you guys. Thank you, folks, for another great one, and I'll catch you in a week, I guess.
Yeah, I'll see whether or not we can maybe get this a different day, so you guys aren't having to be pinned down at the same time every week. But
I'll
let you know when I've looked at my shifts.
Yeah, I mean it's all about my shifts now as well. So I'll just try. We'll just keep in touch and try and get it all worked out. Yeah, I think for me, the earlier in the day the better, or the earlier in the evening the better. Okay. If it's a day off. If it's not,
yeah,
then it's not. I don't know. We'll work it out. We'll try and work around each other. And
Max, I'm trying to remember. You 5 hours ahead?
I think 5 hours
behind.
Five hours behind. Yeah. So yeah, it's five. It's like 5:02 right now.
Okay. So we need to work within your time zones and ship work.
we'll make it. We'll find something. even I'm
sure.
Yeah.
Sure, we'll sync up.
Yeah, even if we have to like do it on a break on our phones or something.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Anyway.
We'll make it work.
All right. Anyway, toodaloo, folks at home, and we'll see you soon.
Bye for now.
Toodaloo.